Hello, I'm John Swift.
And I'm Max Matisse.
In this episode, we will be telling the story of the wrongful conviction and eventual acquittal of Dennis Tomasik.
Mary Chartier and Takura Nyamfakutsa, two of ICLE's long-term contributors and the attorneys who fought for the acquittal, brought us the saga involving the Tomasiks. We had a chance to talk to Dennis and Kim, who were kind enough to share their story with us and explore what happened and what it was like for them. We will also hear from Chris and Marty Tieber, who worked for 8 years on Dennis's appeal.
You are putting your client's fate in the hands of 12 people who frequently have a bias against your client before you ever walk into the courtroom. So to think that there's an easy case to win is just false across the board.
Mary's a partner at Chartier and Nyamfakutsa in Okemos, Michigan.
And so you have that bias of, why would someone lie about this? Why would someone go to the police, go to court, lie about this?
Here's Marty Tieber, one of Dennis Tomasik's appellate lawyers.
It didn't take long to figure out that not only was Dennis Tomasik innocent, but there was nothing that ever even happened here.
People assume because someone has been accused or charged, they must be guilty. And that is so antithetical to our country and our Constitution. It really is like heartbreaking, and it's so troubling. And that's how we get to situations where you have innocent people who are sitting in prison and fighting for their life because everyone just assumed they were guilty from the beginning.
Dennis Tomasik married his high school sweetheart, Kim, and was living with his two kids in Comstock Park, Kent County, where he and Kim grew up.
My name is Dennis Tomasik. I'm 56 years old, and I'm a mechanic.
In 2006, Dennis had been working as a tooling engineer for more than 20 years when he got a call from the Kent County Sheriff's Department.
Dennis had never been in trouble before. The sheriff's office had him come to the station to speak with Detective Martin. It is this interview and a recently decided case called State v. Musser that would play a significant role in eventually overturning Dennis's conviction. We will discuss Musser again in a bit. Since this was Dennis's first interaction with law enforcement, we wanted to know what was going through his mind.
Well, I was very perturbed that, you know, they were making the statements they were making without anything to really, you know, back up what they were saying. As far as, you know, having an investigation or anything, they were just basically like, we already know you did this, and we're not here to find out why, or we already know it, but we're here to find out, well, why you did this. She actually got a hold of me at work, and I was, you know, wondering why I was being contacted and what this was all about. And she stated at trial that I never even asked her what it was about. We were quite naive to the whole thing because we had never been, you know, nothing. We were never in anything criminal before, or had any dealings with the Kent County Sheriff's Department or with, you know, any type of law enforcement of any kind.
Ultimately, based on a statement from a single troubled teen, Dennis was charged with criminal sexual conduct involving a young boy under the age of 10 that was alleged to have taken place over a period of 2 years beginning in 1996. Here's Marty talking about that allegation.
It didn't take long to figure out that not only was Dennis Tomasik innocent, but there was nothing that ever even happened here. It wasn't as if they got the wrong person. It was just a completely made-up tale by this young boy.
During Dennis's almost 9 years of incarceration while working and taking care of two kids, Kim Tomasik played an instrumental role and provided crucial information and evidence to the many lawyers who worked on her husband's case. This is Kim.
You know, the accusation came and we had no clue what it was about. And then he had asked the detective on the phone, well, why are you, what is this about? And she said, your name was brought up and I want to talk to you. But she wouldn't tell him what it was about. So we went into the whole thing, you know, we've never had any issues with the law. So I guess, you know, we hired a lawyer who really didn't do a lot, obviously. And what happened was they kept dragging this out and dragging. We kept getting trial dates and then they drop them and we'd get trial dates. And so it drug out for a long time and we just assumed that, you know, they would investigate and then the truth would come out. And then all of a sudden, wham, we were going to trial, which we didn't I guess we didn't really expect, because, you know, we didn't really know what was or how this process worked. So
I was always taught from when I was a kid that, you know, the authorities did their job and they did it right, and it was, you know, a fair system. But I'm here to tell you, it's not a fair system. They basically make the rules and you fall in between the lines. So yeah, it was a scary situation from on my part and, you know, my family's part, because I had a, you know, a 12-year-old daughter and a 16-year-old son. So, you know, it was unbelievable.
We never had an attorney, so we made the mistake of hiring one out of a phone book. So that was our first mistake. I was very disappointed. I wasn't happy. When we went to the preliminary hearing, we all got kicked out. So I kept saying, Dennis, you know, what do you think? I don't know. Like, and I don't know. I've never been in a courtroom. This was all new to us. And we obviously were very naive to how things work. And we went in green and had no clue what we were doing.
And that's probably the biggest mistake. If I wanted to tell anybody something, that, you know, when something like this happens, you have to get somebody to represent you who you can trust.
Looking back now, Dennis didn't get much of a shot at his first trial. The prosecution presented to the jury a video of the police interrogation of Dennis. Additionally, expert testimony was presented to the jury regarding the behavioral indicators of sexual abuse.
I mean, I think his testimony was utterly ridiculous. And because, I mean, he testified essentially anyone could be a child molester, including himself, including the judge, including the jury under the right circumstances. You have Dennis Tomasik, who has no criminal history whatsoever, not one shred of evidence that he is at all interested in children sexually, not interested in children through child pornography, no other claims made. All of a sudden, a middle-aged man is going to see a six-year-old boy and decide, boy, I'm going to rape this kid, and then never do it to another kid, right? And so he tried to say, well, anyone under the right set of circumstances could be a child rapist, which I find to be an absolutely ludicrous position to take. But he had to take it, because otherwise you can't get Dennis Tomasik into sort of any net where you would say, oh, well, see, he fits the profile of a pedophile. He doesn't fit. He fits in absolutely no way whatsoever.
Dennis was ultimately convicted of 2 counts of first-degree criminal sexual conduct and sentenced to 12 to 50 years in prison. After his conviction, Kim had to figure out what to do next.
I kind of went into panic mode, because now I need an appellate attorney. So I went around interviewing lawyers in the Kent County area here. And I took some family with me, and that is how I ended up with the Tiber Law Firm, with Marty and Chris Tiber. And that was just such a blessing, because I tell you, I didn't sleep for days. And when I talked to Marty, he wasn't even in Kent County, he was in Lansing, East Lansing. He said, well, I don't just take any case. And I said, good, read it for yourself. And then you call me back, because I didn't want anybody that just took any case. I wanted him to read it for himself and make that decision. And he did.
Kim met Marty and Chris at their offices, where she laid out the case. Here are the Tiber's first impressions, starting with Chris.
You know, honestly, once you're just an initial read, and you could just see what the situation was, that this was a total travesty, that this young child that was very troubled made this false accusation against this man who was a great father and worked hard and just a wonderful family. And that was evident from the very start. So I think it just, you know, it immediately brought up our ires, and, you know, we understood that something had to be done for this family.
My initial reaction on meeting Kim and hearing what she had to say was, if she's telling me the truth, and she seemed very believable, this is an astounding situation.
We asked Marty about how hard and demoralizing the experience was for Dennis.
I remember we did a series of evidentiary hearings in the trial court in the early years of the case, and our intent was to put Dennis on the stand, but it became clear very quickly to me when he was in the holding area in the courthouse that was not going to be possible, that he was just unable to deal with the situation that was surrounding him. And I understand that. I mean, I can't imagine that I could possibly be able to deal with what happened to him. But I think he evened out a little bit. But as Chris said, that was definitely the low point for us throughout the process, was worrying about the toll that was taking on not only Dennis, but Kim and his kids, and wondering, why can't we get this done a little quicker? It was frustrating at times.
We asked Dennis and Kim about the low points they experienced while Dennis was incarcerated.
The worst time was when they, you know, moved me and then put me down in that Jackson. And for a while, they take you down to what they call a orientation, where they check you off, make sure you don't have any SCDs or whatever, any diseases of any type, and run all kinds of tests on you before they distribute you throughout the prisons in Michigan. So that was a real harsh environment there. Level 4 was 23 hours lockdown for 4 years, you know. So I was very fortunate. I had a very good bunkie for a long time who I got along with very, very well. So, yeah, I was very fortunate. People are like, oh, everybody says they're innocent. No, they don't say that. Most people say, yeah, I did this, I did that, you know. Maybe I didn't do that. Maybe I didn't kill this guy, but, you know, who knows, you know. I just tried to get along the best I could in a terrible situation, you know.
So I didn't see Dennis for a couple of years there, but then I did start going back randomly here and there. The big thing was, is the kids. He did not let the kids come back. So the kids didn't see him for like 4 or 5 years.
Prison, there's a lot of people, a lot of sick people in there, and I wasn't very uppity on that visiting room and the way that people conduct themselves inside that visiting room. So
we sent some pictures of cars. My son had bought a car. And it was his first purchase of his own. So he wanted to send it to his dad and show him the pictures of the car and the motor, because they're gearheads and that's what they do. I slipped a picture in there of my father with all of the grandchildren. And Dennis had called when he got the pictures. And he said, he saw the picture and he was looking at it. And he said, well, who's the blonde? Well, the blonde was our daughter. That was hard because he didn't see her from like the age of 14 until she was like 20.
There is quite a bit of procedural history to this case, so I'm going to attempt to give a very brief summary of what happened. Dennis was convicted of 2 counts of first degree CSC in 2007. 3 years later, the Court of Appeals upheld those convictions. The next year, the Michigan Supreme Court vacated that ruling and remanded Dennis's case back to the trial court because the counseling records of the victim had never been made available to Dennis's team. The trial court denied the defense's motion for a new trial, and the Court of Appeals affirmed that decision. Then, in 2013, the Musser decision came down from the Michigan Supreme Court. That case required prosecutors to, at a minimum, redact portions of police interrogation videos when presenting them to a jury. Based on that decision, as well as a couple of other issues, the Michigan Supreme Court sent the case back to the Court of Appeals to reconsider the case. In 2014, the Court of Appeals again affirmed Dennis's conviction. So the Tebers took the case back to the Michigan Supreme Court in 2015. This time, rather than send the case back to the Court of Appeals, the Michigan Supreme Court ordered Kent County to give him a new trial.
We asked Chris and Marty if they ever thought of giving up in the 8 years of direct appeals back and forth between the Court of Appeals and the Michigan Supreme Court.
There was never any question about this case. You know, I would have taken it another 8 years if it had taken that. At a certain point, the fact that you're doing it without pay doesn't really matter, because it was so clear to Chris and I that Dennis Tomasik was absolutely innocent. This prosecution destroyed this family, and we were going to do whatever we needed to do to do our best to right this wrong. And I'm just thankful that it finally happened. There was a point where I was getting a little bit upset with the Michigan Supreme Court, but on their behalf, I will say that they never let it go. I wish they would have done this much earlier in the process, this final order, which was based on a Musser issue.
The following is a clip from Chris's argument before the Michigan Supreme Court, where he focuses on the Musser issue, the problem with admitting the video of Dennis's interrogation into evidence and playing it for the jury.
I'm going to begin with the Musser issue. The introduction of the entire interrogation with no redaction in this case was highly prejudicial against Mr. Tomasik and improper under this court's ruling in People versus Musser. The jury was allowed to hear that the investigating detective in this case say any number of things that would obviously not be able to come through on direct testimony. I'm going to just list a few here. I'm not going to lie about anything. I know my investigation skills are there. I'm very thorough. I investigated the heck out of this case, indicating that prior work was done, and I know that everything is going on here. She alluded to interviewing the family prior to and investigating those aspects, and again repeating that everything they said would be true, and that she repeatedly said that she believed the complainant in this case. Now, clearly, this is the type of improper vouching that, again, and the backdrop of a straight-up credibility contest is severely prejudicial against the client and against any defendant, and exactly the type of situation that this court unanimously decided in Musser would not be allowed.
Next, you hear Justice Joan Larson asking Chris whether the mistakes made in the trial actually influence the outcome.
But isn't the difference in Musser that counsel actually objected? So here, counsel didn't object to the introduction. So to find for your client, we'd have to find under plain error?
Plain error, correct.
Okay.
And I believe that in this situation, that it clearly rises to that standard. That there, it clearly is outcome determinative in this case.
But outcome determinative can't be enough, right? In order to get over prong four of our plain error jurisprudence, we have to decide that the error that your client is actually innocent, or that it seriously affected the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of judicial proceedings independent of the defendant's innocence. So can you explain to me how that standard is met here?
Sure. First off, the proofs against him basically, again, come down to only that of the complainant.
Here's Chris again from our interview talking about what he was thinking during those oral arguments.
Yeah, I felt really good coming out of there. Well, I felt really good after, basically I felt really good about this case from the beginning. But as Marty said, it started to get a little frustrating as we kept going up back and forth. But I never lost faith that the law was on our side and the facts were on our side and the truth was on our side. So
we decided to get the opinion of another expert on this case.
Hello, it's Dave Moran.
Dave Moran is the director of the Michigan Innocence Clinic at the University of Michigan Law School. We asked Dave about his opinion of the Tomasik case, since it's similar to many of the cases he handles at the Innocence Clinic.
They are very resistant to grant new trials in criminal cases, no matter what. And I mean, that's been constant with our experience in the Michigan Court of Appeals. We've been around since 2009. We've now won 23 cases. And only once have we won in the Court of Appeals of those 23 cases. So you see that pattern in this case where the Michigan Supreme Court keeps sending it back to the Court of Appeals and says, here's something else you should think about. And the Court of Appeals says, no, that doesn't matter. We're still going to affirm. And so finally, after 8 years or so of litigation, all still on the initial direct appeal, there never was a post-conviction motion filed in this case.
Dave pointed out that this is a somewhat objectively hard case to try because it largely hinged on the testimony of a teenage boy that lacked credibility.
The prosecution tried to bolster the testimony of the boy with a bunch of, frankly, junk. Other people coming in with opinions about how, this fits the pattern. And so the court, the Michigan Supreme Court, over the past 10, 12 years, has recognized that a lot of this testimony is junk, that, bolstering sexual abuse claims by by people coming in and basically saying, you know, trust me, this is the real deal. And so, the case wasn't very good to begin with, but it was bolstered by having a detective testify, or not testify, but interrogate Tomasik and be played for the jury how she investigated the heck out of this case, and you know, she knew it was true. What's remarkable is just how long it took, because it kept going back to the Court of Appeals, which refused to take the hint and kept reaffirming.
We asked Dave to address the Musser issue specifically.
Tomasik never made any incriminating statements at all. And so there was no actual purpose to play the video. There was no reason that the video should have been admitted at all. And so it seems that the only purpose that the prosecution had for playing it was so that the jury could hear these confident statements from the detective. They sent it back for Musser, among other things. And, you know, that should have been the end of it. You would think at that point the Court of Appeals would have got it, but they didn't. Yeah, I mean, these cases are tough to bring, but they should be tough to bring. It should be tough to convict somebody based entirely on the testimony of a very troubled kid with a history of lying.
Chris was just out of law school when the firm took the case. He learned quickly what it takes to get a case to the appellate level and keep it alive.
You know, that things can happen along the lines and you might get frustrated, but if you, you know, believe in a case and you work hard at it, that, you know, hopefully the right thing ends up happening. And so that definitely gave me faith in the system. So that helps. As far as, you know, everything else, I mean, every case is different, obviously, and the issues are different. But, you know, I learned a lot about, you know, I did my first Supreme Court argument and, you know, like I said, we did over 20 pleadings in this case. So it definitely taught me a lot about the law.
Being an appellate lawyer is a very hard thing to do, you know, because the reward is so far out there. But, you know, they worked diligently on it for all those years. And like my wife said, basically pro bono, you know, I had a 401k. We spent every cent I had. Plus, you know, I had to borrow money from my relatives just to, you know, keep going and trying to keep, you know, money flowing into them so that they would, you know, and after a point, they're just like, well, we know you don't have any more, but we're not going to give up, because if it wasn't for them, I'd still be sitting there.
With the Supreme Court order sending the case back for a new trial, the Tebers had to get Kim and Dennis to the right trial lawyers. We asked Marty about handing the case over to Mary and to Cora.
I was just really impressed with Mary. So when we got the order granting the new trial, I also knew that she did work in Grand Rapids. In fact, they have a Grand Rapids office. So I immediately called her and I said, Mary, I don't know if Kim and Dennis can afford your services, but please, you've got to do this trial. And I explained a little bit about the case to her, and I think she was hooked as we were hooked at that point.
Given their experience with the original trial attorney, we wanted to know what it was like for Dennis and Kim to meet Mary and Takora.
Well, of course, I was very apprehensive of anybody, but because of what had happened before. But again, you know, these were referred to my wife, Kim, by Marty and Chris. She wasn't, you know, just out shopping for a lawyer. These were references she was acquiring from them. So, you know, after what they did, I knew they weren't going to be, you know, whoever they were going to say to go talk to would probably be the best people in the state, you know, as far as doing a case like this.
While Dennis was granted a new trial, he remained incarcerated for 4 months after the Supreme Court order before being released on a $150,000 bond. The 9 years of appeals have wiped out the Tomasics financially, but in an overwhelming show of support, their family and friends raised $15,000 cash to get him out of jail. Unfortunately, the delay prevented Dennis from attending his own mother's funeral. This is Takura Naimfukuza, Mary's law partner.
It was Marty who called my business partner, Mary, and said, look, I need you to do me a favor. This family cannot afford you. And Marty, at that point, had been practicing for, I think, about 30 years at least. And he said in all his years, he'd never met anyone who he believed was factually innocent. Because a lot of times we try cases and we say, look, no matter what the government is alleging, they can't prove it, right? the burden of proof is too high. They can't surmount it. But this one was a case which he truly believed involved a person who was factually innocent. And we believe the same after he told us everything.
Here's Mary again.
Kim Tomasik was, she was everything. She was so instrumental to this case. She's a dream. I mean, she's absolutely just a dream. I wish, you know, everyone's spouse could be Kim Tomasik. She was fantastic. So she would, for the 9 years that Dennis was in prison, she would take off that file nightly, put it on her dining room table or on her living room floor, and create all these charts of inconsistencies, pull documents that potentially could help. So it was unbelievably helpful. And they identified a boatload of witnesses for us to contact. And then Takura did the bulk of contacting the witnesses and then prepping them and then deciding which ones we would use at trial and which ones we didn't. Because a jury, you know, they'll only sit for so long. So, you know, we could have had 50 people coming in and saying he was at work, but, you know, obviously we're not going to put 50 people on to say the same thing, but we did put, you know, probably 10 people on to say the same thing, but all of them had a little something to add. The biggest hurdle in this case is really the same as the biggest hurdle in a lot of cases, and it's that bias of the public. So you're walking in where there's an allegation of criminal sexual conduct against a child and repeated criminal sexual conduct against a child. There's nobody on that jury who is not looking at your client and really trying to assess right away whether this guy is guilty or not.
Getting a jury to recognize their own bias is very difficult. Here's Mary talking about how she addresses that.
Asking really thought-provoking questions from individuals who are on the jury, or at least in the jury pool and possibly on the jury, to try and ascertain, for example, whether they believe children would never lie about something like this. A lot of people have that misconception. A lot of people have that, not just jurors, but I mean, we see that from politicians, right? If someone makes a claim of sexual harassment or sexual assault, they have to be believed. And that's a great attitude if you want to be a supportive family member or friend, but that is not the attitude that a juror should have. I mean, that doesn't afford due process to a client at all. Certainly doesn't comport with any constitutional principles. So asking those open-ended questions where people feel safe to talk about their opinions, I don't even call it a bias, but just their opinions on these issues, to try and ascertain, will they be open-minded enough that they can really assess the evidence in the way that it needs to be assessed.
I asked Mary about the credibility of the complainant and how to call that into question without alienating the jury.
Sure. So that's something that you have to do, right? So how you do it, whether it's, you know, a hard or soft cross, how you bring that to the jury's attention is strategy on the part of the defense team. But absolutely, you have to point out a lack of credibility on the part of the complainant or inconsistencies in what has been said. I mean, that's something that you have to do. And I don't think jurors hold that against the lawyer. I've heard some people occasionally say, oh, well, you know, they're going to hold it against me if I do that. They really won't, because jurors want to do the right thing. Fundamentally, they take, in my experience, they take their jobs extremely seriously. If you are organized and prepared, they want to follow along, and they will not hold it against you to point out, well, here you said one thing, then you changed your story, then you changed your story again. And you have to do that, especially in this case where we had a complainant who had told vastly different stories throughout the years. I mean, it was remarkable. And that was not done in the first trial. And I think that was a huge misstep on the part of the trial lawyer.
Anyone who's taken a trial prep course knows that you need to present a theme to the jury. We asked Mary if she had one for Dennis's case.
So it's interesting, you know, it's always right that the government hasn't met their burden. So, I mean, that's what you always argue. The government hasn't met their burden. In this case, it was really important for Dennis to really present that he was innocent, not just that the government didn't meet their burden, but that he was really innocent of these offenses. That's a bit of a departure. You know, we certainly don't do that in all of our cases, even when a client is innocent, because it does have the real, you know, possibility of almost shifting that burden a little bit. So we'll have clients who are absolutely innocent, but, you know, we're not really hitting that so heavy. For Dennis, we did. That was strategic, and we did it, and obviously it worked. The big theme of this, though, that we were able to intertwine is, you know, we had a complainant who was mentally ill, in my opinion, and in also the records that we had. So he had some mental health issues that came out at trial. So you have a young man who has some serious issues that are not his fault, right? I mean, being mentally ill is not someone's fault. But then you had the government, both prosecutor and police, who never really questioned what they were being told at all. When Dennis Tomasik says to the police, I couldn't have done this, right? I was at work. You don't need to be Sherlock Holmes to know what your next move is. Your next move is to go to work, right? Because now somebody's going to say, well, I wasn't home. I was at work on all these various times. You go to the guy's job and you find out when he works.
The theme in this trial was more than just Dennis is innocent.
Because if he's lying to you, that makes your case stronger for the government. And if he's telling you the truth, then you don't put an innocent man and his family through this. And you don't send an innocent man to prison for 9 years. So much of a trial, winning a trial, happens before you ever walk into the courtroom. It's knowing what someone has said to their counselor, to a teacher, to a parent, then to the police again, then at the exam. So it's knowing what all those stories have been and then matching up and saying, well, are there inconsistencies that someone who was telling the truth would not have?
After the Supreme Court ordered a new trial for Dennis, but while he is still incarcerated, the prosecution offered him a plea deal.
It was given to me right away. You can walk away from this if you want to take a plea and let this go on your record, you know, as being on the offender list the rest of my life. And I'm like, no, I didn't come this far to take any plea for anything. I didn't do it, so I need to go back to trial.
We talked about this going on, and there were a number of people who came and said, oh, just take a plea, walk away. They were very fearful to go back into that courtroom.
With the same judge.
Here's Mary again explaining the details of the plea deal that the prosecution put on the table.
So they made him an offer. If he pled no contest to criminal sexual conduct in the first degree, he would spend no further time in custody, no more jail, no probation, or no prison, no parole, nothing, right? He would just be done. He would just walk out. He'd have to register as a sex offender. But other than that, he would totally be done. And he could plead no contest, which meant he would never have to say what he did. And Dennis, you know, he turned that down immediately. He said, absolutely not. I'm not going to admit to something I didn't do. I don't care if I spend the rest of my life in prison. I'm not going to admit to something I didn't do. We never advise clients whether to take an offer or not, because we're not the ones who have to live with the results. We're not the ones who go to prison if we lose at trial. We're not the ones who have to walk around being registered as a sex offender if he takes the deal. We do go over with clients, and we'll go over it at length, the pros and cons of the offer, the risks of taking the offer versus the risks of going to trial. And we'll point out in cases, okay, well, here are all the people who are going to be testifying to this. This is going to be a big hurdle for us at trial. So we'll talk about it really in a very in-depth manner for as long as someone wants. But ultimately, the decision is theirs.
This is Takura again.
That was a great deal of trust that he placed in us. And it was almost a complete reversal of the roles, because ordinarily it's us. We're the ones arguing, oh, never mind those 23 witnesses that the government put on the witness stand. This is why you can't believe them. But you never know. The jurors, they had poker faces like none other. And I just know that we did all that we could, you know, in the preparation, finding so many witnesses, and having all that evidence that we were able to send back with them. But you never know, because we prevailed on cases that we thought we didn't have a chance on, and the opposite has been true. But there was more pressure here because we believed so strongly that Dennis was factually innocent. And that knot in the stomach, it didn't go away. And you always wonder, boy, should we have put them all on? Did they at some point zone out? Were we boring them? These are all the things that were bouncing around in my head. And I was asking myself, boy, could I have asked any of those questions differently?
One question that the defense asked of their witnesses during trial was whether they had ever testified before. Most of them said no. It really drove home the point that the jury in the original trial didn't have much to go on when they made their decision. We wanted to talk to Takura about that and get his take on it.
Once they knew, right, once the cat was out of the bag and they knew that this was a retrial, the fact that all these people took the stand and had never been given an opportunity, I think made it pretty clear that whatever happened the first time around was not a defense at all.
After closing arguments and jury instructions, the jury went to deliberate and were back with a verdict in less than 25 minutes. We asked Kerr if that was surprising to have them come back so quickly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We, in fact, were still packing up. We hadn't made it to the restroom yet. And when we were told that they wanted to come back in, the jury, we thought they had a question because that's not unusual. But the clerk said, no, they have a verdict. In that moment, I felt a chill go down my spine. And I thought, oh, my goodness, I should have put them all on, or I shouldn't have put so many on. And I thought, my goodness, all this time, all this preparation, all these witnesses, and they come back that quickly. So I thought, boy, it's either really, really good or terrible. Both of us were flanking Dennis. Then they read the verdict and he just collapsed. He fell down to his knees and I was right there too.
Like the biggest weight has ever been lifted off my head and this is all done. And yeah, it was a great feeling for sure. Probably the best feeling other than seeing my kids born and grandkids. I got lucky. I didn't get to see my son get married because I was in there, but I just got a new grandson this year and I got a little granddaughter coming along here in December. So I'm glad I was here to see all that.
I think the lawyers were probably more nervous than I was. I knew that God had brought us that far. He'd given us the right people. And Dennis and I had talked about that win or lose didn't matter as much. It mattered. No, I take that back. It mattered. But even if we lost, they gave it 150%. They had so much evidence. I couldn't imagine in my heart that jurors wouldn't get it.
Here's Dave Moran again, giving a little context on how Dennis's case compares to some of the cases he's worked on.
Yeah, I've been an appellate attorney for 27 years, handled hundreds and hundreds of appeals at Sato and since then. I've never seen a direct appeal last 8 years. Never seen one that long last that long. That's you know, the average serious felony criminal appeal in Michigan lasts a couple of years, including a remand for a hearing in the trial court. So 8 years like this is orders of magnitude or standard deviations beyond the norm. We've got a long way to go, but I think the Michigan Indigent Defense Commission is really helping by setting forth a standard that indigent defense is expected to meet. And we've seen a rash of public defender offices open around the state. And I think that's a huge, hugely positive development.
After about 20 minutes of deliberation, the jury came back with a verdict, not guilty. 11 years after the first trial, and 8 years, 11 months, and 3 days in prison, the verdict was a confirmation of everything that Kim and Dennis, their friends and family, knew. Dennis was fully exonerated after a direct appeal that took 8 years, and countless trips between the Michigan Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, and the trial court, and a result that the Tebers and Marion Takura worked for.
We asked the lawyers to try to break down some of the lessons of this case that attorneys might be able to apply going forward.
You've got to be the one that knows the case better than anybody else involved with it. And the only way you can be the one who knows more about the case than anybody else involved with it is to do the work, investigation and research. And you just need to do a ton of it. You need to talk to everybody. You need to take detailed notes on everything. You need to read everything. All of the police reports, all of the court file, all of the transcripts, and you have to take detailed notes on all of that. And when you're at the trial level, it's the same thing. You have to do the investigation. You have to talk to the witnesses. You have to make notes on all of those discussions. And you have to spend a lot of time sifting through it all and know the case absolutely thoroughly, better than anyone else in that courtroom. And that's the way you succeed. It's just a lot of hard work.
You know, Dennis Tomasik was innocent. He went to prison for 9 years. He's been exonerated. He's on the National Registry of Exonerations, but he's not in any way, shape, or form unique at all. What is unique is that the Michigan Supreme Court reversed this conviction and gave him the opportunity to fight again and to prove his innocence. So many people don't get that opportunity for the reason that you earlier stated, right? It's harmless error. You know, it doesn't rise to that level. And so we have innocent people in prison for crimes they didn't commit. Not always because of the fault of the lawyer, sometimes because of bias on the part of the jury, sometimes because a circuit court allowed bogus expert testimony in, right? So fault can be across the board, not just, you know, resting on our side of the aisle. The two takeaways are: be really passionate about what you do, or else, you know, go do something else, right? I mean, if I ever lose my passion, I don't know, I'll be the greeter at the grocery store or whatever. I mean, you know, it's just, this is not the field for someone who's not passionate about defense work and defending our clients and the Constitution, and recognizing that Dennis's situation is only unique because he's been exonerated, not because he was an innocent man accused. So many innocent people are accused every day, and it's very troubling where our country's headed in that regard.
If we could prevent somebody from having to face a jury, right? If we can do a thorough investigation, and that means that they never, you know, have to have someone deliver an opening argument on their behalf, I think that's a better outcome than that not guilty verdict.
We were grateful and honored that Kim and Dennis were willing to be so open with us while sharing their story.
I hope that it helps to prevent other false incarcerations, because it's not a good place to be.
Thank you for wanting to talk to us. I always like talking to people. I like to let people know what happened.
After 9 years in prison, Dennis Tomasik is getting his life back. He's returned to his hometown in Comstock, Michigan, where he's living with Kim and the community that supported him. He's working again, and he's watching his grandchildren grow up.